welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, your regular host for the show since 2015, and also founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity, working to bring more choice and control to those facing a diagnosis of cancer. One of the most rapidly developing arenas in integrative oncology in recent years is the repurposing of drugs for metabolic cancer control. Starting around a decade ago with the appearance of Jane McClelland on the scene, followed by her hugely popular book How to Starve Cancer, there's been an explosion of interest amongst both professionals and patients. Now, there's a new book just published, Metabolic Drugs for Cancer, that brings us right up to date with the very latest science. Its authors are nutritionist Amanda King and oncologist Dr. Hari Kuhn. And I'm delighted to be speaking to them both. Welcome, Hari and Amanda. Really great to have you on the Yes Life show.
Thanks for having us here.
Thank you for having us, Robin. Good to see you.
So, we're here today to talk about a collaboration you've been working on recently, a new book. It's about to hit the book stands, I understand. Perhaps one of you would like to introduce the book, give us the title and the contents.
Yeah, sure. So the title is Metabolic Drugs for Cancer. And we've both been working on this for some time now. And the content, really what we've tried to do is to create a book that helps people to have access to more detailed, what is more considered quite detailed biochemistry, information about how the drugs work, what they work well with, what cancers they work well for, but to put it into language which the average Joe can have a good chance of understanding, not to overcomplicate an already very complicated subject.
It certainly isn't a complicated subject, but nonetheless, lots of people are diving in there. Why? Because they're trying to save their lives. And so I'm sure that this will be very welcome, your book.
Yeah, the book is written for the general public. But because so little is really known about the area of off-label drugs, repurposed drugs at present, I actually think that it's going to be a useful resource for practitioners too. So there's a lot of information. It's heavily, heavily referenced with a lot of up-to-date information.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. It has to be available, translatable, you know, from the lay person as a label to those practitioners who, again, are very confused, you know, as you know, with this emerging situation of AI driven questioning, lines of questioning, etc. A patient, a loved one is obviously going to be, I guess, driven to sort of seek other things, as we know. This is the premise of our conversation and this group, of course. And they will be somewhat flabbergasted. A patient will be asking them about metformin, for example. You know, well, let's go to another end of the spectrum, ivermectin. And so to have a body of work, you know, that is, as Amanda said, we want to make a difference in critically, heavily referenced, up-to-date data, very recent data, not just data years ago, 10 years ago, or up-to-date data, a sort of a stamp with some sort of medical authority, maybe, if that's what I could bring to some degree in terms of consideration of dosing. But it was also meant to be a trigger of further conversation, another stepping stone towards a hopeful time in our lifetime, maybe, where actually it isn't a stigma to consider adjunctive protocols with conventional treatment plans. So, exactly. And that's kind of why, you know, I think we've all noticed there are still two sides to this coin. There are those on one side, conventional, and those who are labeled as non-conventional. And the integrative practitioners are doing their very best, of course, to use data-driven publications. But still, it's quite sluggish, you know, in terms of, yes, we can talk about vitamin D, maybe, and whatever. But off-label drugs, the fact that drug repurposing is such a well-known entity, to be dismissed by either side, conventional or those who are or more maybe naturopathically minded, seems like we're missing a trick. So the key word, and I've been, you know, saying this quite a lot, you know, Amanda and I have been, the collaboration, you know, we're trying to bridge the gap, trying to move everyone together, trying to have a conversation, trying to show the evidence base. Yeah. And of course, you know, also try and remain, keep everyone grounded. You know, this is not a case of patients should see the book and go out and privately buy medicines at doses quoted, is to just educate and sort of try and again, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Open doors. Brilliant. So a kind of dual function in a way. You're trying to obviously inform the public, but you're also trying to reassure conventional oncologists that this is actually good science and it could
yep.
really help their patients. So a great combination. So you've got two fairly different roles. Maybe you'd like to just introduce your roles to say exactly what you do, and then tell us what you think you've been able to achieve by combining forces to write this book.
So I'm first and foremost a nutritional therapist and also naturopathic practitioner. And so I weave in lots of modalities into my work. And obviously some of that is integrative oncology, other things like nutrigenomics come in there as well. So my paradigm is it's very naturopathic. This is how I work and, you know, from a naturopathic point of view, you might even say that off-label drugs are not naturopathic. We don't work with medicines. But the reality is that what we're trying to do is show that nothing is off the table in the scenario where we're dealing with these kinds of extreme situations where people are fighting for their lives and you know, they've got, you know, a disease that... you know, we still don't know and have all the answers. We're still doing loads of research to try and help people to overcome. So in the book, I have weaved in lots of information about how these drugs work synergistically with things like the ketogenic diet and how movement and community and actually stress management, other kinds of more traditional naturopathic modalities are to be used as well as off-label drugs. So what we're trying to do is bring everything, show people that it's not a one-trick pony. It's not just a conventional approach that's needed or just a naturopathic. We need to bring everything and not cast anything aside or dismiss anything when we're working in this way.
Great. Harry?
Yeah, in my background, so I trained in medical oncology in central London. So I graduated from Imperial College, BSE in surgery and anaesthesia. Did my core medical training throughout London, St. Mary's and Paddington, Colchester actually as well. Moved on to sort of specialist training in oncology at St. Bartholomew's Hospital. And then attained a national training number towards consultancy. So I worked throughout London. Royal Marsden, in Fulham and in Sutton, developed an interest in trials. So went into early phase clinical trials at Sarah Cannon Research Institute, and also spent some time in the labs working in on pancreatic cancer stem cells and sort of metabolic approaches using repurposed medicines, which sort of is what introduced me to the idea of the metabolic approach, let alone off-label drugs. Wanting to further that career, my brain patterns have been slightly tweaked by working in trials and working in research. I pursued a role at a London clinic where we used off-label medicines as an adjunctive protocol, and in that time frame evolved further as a doctor, becoming more I guess au fait with the conversations around supplement protocols, intravenous therapies. Of course, the great Jane McClelland was a big inspiration for me to evolve. A lot of patients asking me the sort of questions around the typical supplements and whatnot. So I tried to apply my conventional mindset to that world. You know, so the clinical practice, the worrying about interactions, worrying about liver function, all of that kind of stuff, the nuances that you must be aware of. And so I then found myself in a bit of a niche sort of expertise of coming from the conventional world and embracing more the non-conventional stuff, trying to walk the line. Not be a poster boy for just conventional, but trying to just find happy marriages, you know, of various elements based on the patient's circumstance. And I relatively recently actually started off my own clinic. It's called Lucio Health. I focused on tailor-made plans for patients, adjunctive protocols using next-generation sequencing, AI tools such as those employed by Astron Health, sensitivity testing in vitro based on liquid biopsies with blood samples. So I tried to bring it all together to provide a service where, you know, I can maybe provide a forum to talk openly with patients and maybe not be as abrasive as others might be. And I must say as well, it's been a brilliant sort of a time for me in growing, working with Amanda, others in the space, Joe Gamble, Embracing Nutrition, Patricia P, all these powerhouse names that we know of. But the learning as much as I have from Amanda about the role of functional testing, heavy metals, fungal, things, the importance of the microbiome, and to a state of a heightened awareness of the many, many, many more moving parts there are beyond just prescribing a conventional treatment. So that's kind of my, a précis of how I got to where I was.
Yeah, excellent. So, just to be clear, that in many ways you could describe the barrier that we're trying to cross here with integrative medicine as a theoretical barrier, in as much as the lion's share of conventional medicine is working with the somatic mutation theory still, even though it's rather past its sell-by date. They haven't got a replacement. And you're talking about, particularly with repurposed drugs, they don't even make any sense whatsoever, really, within that paradigm. And we're talking about the metabolic theory, which has been on the rise since about 2012, I suppose. It's broadly accepted by anybody who's working outside of conventional care. That's the way they're working, with an acknowledgement that there are elements of the somatic mutation view which we need to take into account because, genetic mutations, for example, are a thing. They're there, and it's really a chicken and egg situation as to, well, are they the cause or are they a symptom? And, there's disagreements about that. And really, that theory division is still largely driving the separation there is. It's quite difficult to make the leap from the somatic mutation theory to the metabolic theory, because it's a very different way of looking at cancer and therefore at how you treat it. And therefore, for you, Harry, as an oncologist, to sort of get your head around the whole thing is a bit of a deal. But it's fantastic you've done it, because as you said, we want to embrace every possible way of helping people. We don't want to be excluding a huge raft of stuff just because it doesn't fit with our particular mindset. So very interesting. And so this book of yours, I can see, is an attempt to sort of pull this all together into one picture, which is brilliant. Harry, can I ask you, you've just described how you first got involved with in the lab, doing research around some repurposed drugs and pancreatic cancer, and then you moved on, you were actually helping people to go through a protocol of repurposed drugs. And I just like, as a bit of an overview, it's a rapidly developing field. How has it grown from the time when you first became involved, which was really the early days of repurposing, getting some decent attention, up to today? How have things evolved?
Well, I think it's certainly, as you say, evolved. I think there's a scientific front, the real world application front, right? So the scientific front has just steadily grown and grown and grown, and you'll see vast publications, around these different off-label drugs, and now meta-analyses and retrospective reviews. And because, we used to say this a lot. I mean, there's a sort of triangulation of data sets, right? So retrospective reviews, looking back in time, we have a large swathes of data, isolating things statistically, and then going back and then doing the sort of preclinical trials, maybe a phase 1, phase 2, etc. So I think the science and the acknowledgement from the academic perspective has certainly been strengthened and validated. And there's more of a conversation about the logistical benefits of using repurposed medicine, because comparatively it's a sluggish or more sluggish process. And bringing these expensive pharma-driven plans or ideas to the front line, more about the process, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, phase 4, the gold standard of data, which is also part of the problem, and I think they're trying to fix this. The real world thing, I think we always hit a roadblock because, there is this conservative clinical culture, risk averse, if you like.
Yes.
We'll be like, okay, look, I'm prescribing you this. I don't want some dodgy tribal sector, you X, Y, and Z in case it has an impact on X, Y, and Z. And sometimes a bit laughable. We think there'll be a fear mongering about metformin whilst prescribing life-threatening chemotherapy.
Yes.
So there's that. There's a regulatory and the funding challenges, I think, in the NHS and the structure of the NHS and how NICE works, et cetera, whereby we're never going to get that phase three level data. I mean, because the issue is, as you know, we don't believe in one hit wonder solutions. When we talk about the metabolic approach and collaboration, we're talking about diet, we're talking about exercise, we're talking about sleep cycle, we're talking about inflammation, we're talking about the microbiome, we're talking about, yes, maybe some integrative therapies, maybe some nuanced supplements, off-label medicine. So it's very hard to then say, to then present the data in the same academic front or of format, I should say, that the conventional doctors are happy with accepting. So I think, I guess the quandary and the issue is, and this is why conversations like this are so important in getting more awareness and acknowledgement of this is so important, and engaging in the right academic forums is important. I mean, also one of the premises of my clinic is this, to be a bit more regimented about data collection, to get a foot in the door, to be able to present something in ESMO or ASCO or publish in a decent journal, you need to have data. Going into that, what does that even mean? Like, how do you collect data in an array of patients? You know, you have to follow some premise and pick one cancer type. They'll find the right population of patients. This is point A in time. This is the conventional treatment. We're adding this in. Now, that might vary dependent on the individual. And then let's see how long it takes to progress. Your survival, overall survival. So I think, all that's as much as we can do, support the patient, communicate with the overseeing physician, try and drive home awareness, allay the fears, but this is again only through strong channels of communication, collect data sets in some format, present them on the right academic stages, and that movement has to occur. The scientific movement, i.e. the lab-based studies, talking about pathways, talking about the in vitro experiments, maybe some in vivo, that is, continued, it's just been ongoing. And there is a plethora of information there now more available to patients, of course, as well. And that's another headache, trying to translate that academic information into a way, or you can see this in Facebook forums where people get intuitive because without trying to convey these outputs or understand them. But sometimes it just feels like all of that conversation, as important as it is, will not come to fruition because of the structure of the system that we work in conventional medicine. And I think that's the issue. I think the problem is as I said before, that conservative culture. The job of an oncologist, and I don't mean this with any disrespect, is essentially to be a purveyor of the predefined protocol. Right? Particularly in medical oncology, I can say, right? So you fall into this box, into this category. As clever, obviously, as these physicians and doctors are, you're going to get this. You're going to get FOLFOX, you're going to get FOLFIRI, maybe Avastin if you're in the private sector. Then we're going to go to the next one and switch between the two. Then we might get to LONSURF. That's your lot, right? So that is the job. And that's kind of what put me off it a little bit, right? We have great glioblastoma patients who are still just receiving temozolomide and then maybe lamustine or PCB. And then that's your lot. So what do they do? They spend hundreds of thousands of pounds via the funding to go to Germany to get a vaccine treatment or Optune or TTF. So I think this is the thing. So, not to sound too depressing, but I think the science is needed, the movement with the publications are needed, the conversation is needed, the allaying of fears is needed, but this roadblock is the thing that we need to
fill. Right. Well, I'm right with you there. Yeah, it's a system-based culture which looks to itself fundamentally, and it says it's working very hard to be patient-centered, but I don't believe it. It's not really happening. And as you say, when they, these fears about risks with actually supplements, these things are deadly, they all of them have to be avoided if you want to get the treatment. And also the other thing that's completely out of proportion in the risk area is actually, they're busy talking about risk, but the patient is quite often dying. Now, for them, it's a completely different picture. Well, of course I'll take a risk. I want to stay alive. But of course, when you're protecting the system, you're not really interested in that. You're actually going to say, no, we don't do that. We're not going to sort of push the boat out a bit for you to see if we can help you survive. Mm-hmm. So it's a shockingly bad situation. And you're right. It's what I describe as the culture of oncology. And that does need to change in a fundamental way. UK Health Radio.
is a station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And that is something which we've written about in the book quite a lot as well. This health politics side of things is that a lot of these drugs are either off patent, they're generics, not all of them, but this is where the funding does not get put. This is where the trials are not happening. And this is not based on health or based on the benefit of the patient. It's based on profits. And so this is what we need to do is have these conversations and make people aware that, you know, when we have oncologists coming back and saying, well, there's no data available. Well, that's because, you know, any old lab in India can knock these drugs up instead of it being something that's highly profitable, like a GLP-1 agonist, for example, $600 a month per person. But it's a highly profitable billion-pound industry. It is actually an off-label drug for cancer. We have written about that in the book. But, you know, they're going to make millions out of that for it. For Novo Nordisk, for example, but compared to something like ivermectin, when anybody can make it, the research isn't going to be there. So there's a massive amount of health politics around this.
Yeah, it just needs teasing out a bit for people in the UK, because we all understand how in America that the oncologists getting a kickback every time they give out chemotherapy. They make some money directly. And so, you know, talk about incentive to actually give people medicines, whether they need them or not. It's not so obvious in the UK, though, because we have free healthcare. You know, come on, they're not interested in profit. Well, it's true. They're not directly interested in profit, the oncologists isn't, but a number of drivers, incentives, education, perks, all the things that are being showered on our oncologists to keep them on message for the marketing plan of the pharmaceutical companies are still an enormous, enormous force. And funnily enough, the pharmaceutical companies have come to understand the culture of oncology that you were describing, the conservative culture, and how to drive that culture forward and reinforce it and make the most of it from a marketing perspective for themselves. And so, you know, they're sort of hand in glove in this way, in a rather horrible synergistic dance together, which unfortunately results in not very good healthcare and lots of profit.
Yeah.
It's a sad thing. Okay, so onward. So Amanda, maybe you'd like to just tell us a little bit about what's in the book, what people can expect to find there.
Yeah, sure. So it was interesting when you were talking earlier about the differences between the somatic mutation theory and the metabolic theories of cancer, because while we see the distinct theories, and they can definitely start to be distinct in many ways, there are to some degree some overlap. So in some ways, what we see is upregulation of certain genes, for example, in cancer, like, you know, 3K or AKT. There are certain like variations in the way that some individuals' bodies behave. And so what we've tried to do in the book is to explain what those things mean, So lots of people will hear, well, what the hell is a 3K and what's an AKT when it's at home? We've tried to explain what these things are, what the impacts are, how they actually work. So if they're doing something to the DNA, for example, and what that might mean. Does it mean increased cancer growth? And then what that drug actually would do. So again, in layperson's terms, in language that is not so difficult to understand, maybe with a more of a storytelling aspect to it, so that the person reading gets to really get a sense of why they would take that drug and for what purpose and what cancers it is shown to work best in, and also where there is mixed data, where previously, because we've gone to the latest information today, we've got a lot of data from 2023 onwards up to now and lots from this year. So not just to go, off-label drugs are wonderful, don't they do everything for everybody? No, it's where is it actually somewhere we might need to not use them? What kind of cancers have been shown to be equivocal? Where we thought it was good for ovarian cancer, now we're not so sure. So urging a bit of caution. So the other thing as well is that we've tried to show where there are synergies. So some things work well with TMZ, which you were talking about for glioblastoma. Other things might work well with doxorubicin, and other things work well with intravenous vitamin C therapy. So what we've tried to do is make sure that these individual drugs have been, wherever there is a synergy that's been shown in the data, that we've mentioned that so that people know that it can be useful alongside conventional therapies. Not instead of, you know, it's not alternative. We're looking to integrate, as Harry said, to bridge the gap.
Okay, well, maybe Harry, you could just flesh that out a bit. This is the big number. Is like, oh no, you can't take this at the same time as conventional therapy. It's dangerous. The truth can be a long way from that. It can actually be really good to take them along with conventional therapy. So do you want to just give the overview on repurposing and conventional therapy together?
Absolutely. So I think it's true to say that, you know, there is a potential liability for people on their own and just like, you know, as they might do with any resource and buy a plethora of drugs from India or wherever, you know, just because they've read about it somewhere. You're going to need specialist oversight, right? Because at the end of the day, everybody's different. All these classes of drugs are, in the conventional sense, are very different. They're broken down by the liver and the different enzymes that are employed. And you know, as any functional medicine practitioner or an integrative doctor will know, I mean, the body itself as an environment can be very different from person to person. So the way they process drugs can be very, very different. That's conventional and non-conventional. So just a side comment. I mean, this is probably going to be one of many books, right, Amanda?
Yeah.
Succinct.
Irons are in the fire.
So realize that we might need to do a few more on individual cancers and things like that. But this is a step one. So to question Robin, I mean, this is why, like, I, you know, again, we don't ever want, and this is, I pride myself so far, touch wood, have not been, you know, have run into trouble by prescribing adjunctive protocols because of the method. The safety net, the clear evaluation of the case, the individual's bloods, treatments they're actually receiving. Because there's one thing about the theory that we're focusing on a bit here, but it's about the application. How do you logistically find a plausible plan for the circumstance, individual treatment they're receiving, etc. So yes, I was talking about communication with the fine, but the actual nitty gritty of the plan has to be very well refined to the individuals. That's why self or others, whoever, you know, are so necessary, right? And Amanda, for, obviously, as well. So I'll give you a bunch of examples, right? So immunotherapy, PD-L1 inhibitors or checkpoint inhibitors we might use for melanoma, certain lung cancers, certain triple-negative breast cancers, etc. Side effect profile, very daunting as always, all the autoimmune sequelae, autoimmune hepatitis, autoimmune colitis, so inflammation, itis, inflammation, thyroid can go off, etc., right? So you might want to, if a patient's about to start treatment, say, okay, just see how you get on with that first cycle first. Let's see how your bloods are doing. And then you might want to be conscious that you don't want to overburden the liver, right? Because at the end of the day, the liver's in charge of breaking down a multitude of different things. And if you go all full whack with 10 new, you know, off-label drugs all at once, because the theory said it was a good idea, problems, you know, most importantly for the patient, but the backlash as well will work against the movement, right? So this is why not that's not my priority, but I'm just thinking, you know, we want to do this in the right way. And I've always tried to do this. Let's take chemotherapy, right? You'll see they automatically, a chemo pharmacist will say, no turmeric, no garlic, no ginger, no black seed oil, right? And, you know, and Amanda and I have feelings about this. And so I sometimes play it safe and say, oh, a day before, day of, day after, or 2 days after the chemotherapy infusion, dependent on the half-life of that specific chemotherapy, we might avoid certain supplements. But then, you know, but outside that sort of time zone, it should be okay, because we're talking about chemistry here, right? And so ongoing blood monitoring, looking at all these bloods, having open channels of communication. My patient, you know, I'm pretty busy because I've got just under 400 patients, but my patient emails about 100 a day. But I need to be on top of that, because this is a dynamic situation. Things can change in between reviews. So these are just examples, PARP inhibitors that can lower your neutrophil counts, right? We've got to make sure we're not on anything that might suppress it. What if too much nebendazole might impact it? Unlikely to, but again, be cautious. If your platelets are low, we should probably not be on some aspirin, on some celecoxib, maybe ease off the curcumin and black seed oil as well, just for a time zone, you know? So they're just dynamic reactivity, conscious thought up front. All of these aspects are so important. So this is the thing. This is, I guess, what we've had to bring to the table. Patients will be lost about diet. Lost. They've picked up on low glycemic index, Mediterranean, ketogenic aspects, you know, red bits and bobs, are trying to do it themselves. So every time I'll say, Amanda, her joke handful, it's like, because my knowledge goes only so far. So I don't profess to know everything, but we can't have patients becoming cachexic. We know that they should have protein, you know, intake as opposed to certain types, obviously carbs and, you know, all that. So those nuances are important. So that blend, as we're saying, of conventional with repurposed medicines or the other aspects of our interest, you know, has to be very closely overseen, you know. And I always say to patients, look, the initial couple of months are important. We need to take our time to build slowly, cautiously, learn about you as an individual, how you as an individual tolerate these individual agents, stagger introduction, one at a time, cautious method, look at your bloods, and then you're up and running. Hopefully you'll have I need to earn your confidence that you are tolerating this as an individual well. And this is the thing, there's a plethora of things, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, the way they're broken down by the liver. A patient will ask me, okay, I've got this rash all of a sudden, or I'm feeling more nauseous, or my guts are really disturbed. Is it the metformin? Probably, you know? So as you can see, in front of, there are many, many different eventualities that I have to be mindful of. And that's kind of why, again, I find myself in a bit of a niche, because I'm very grounded. I always try and tell patients to reassure them, very grounded by my conventional principles of training and what's important and what has to be prioritized if the patient has signed the dotted line for that conventional treatment, was that conventional treatment, front line and center. So I've got no right to, or backing to be able to say that wasn't the case yet. Maybe one day it'll change. But everything I do must be carefully thought, carefully laid out, carefully detailed, communicated with, and then, as I said, going from there, maintaining open channels of communication to help.
The station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at ukhealthradio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tennis Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the Skin Comfort Formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I think it's a really great point that you've said about the testing. I mean, this is part of the metabolic approach as well, is that there is no guesswork here. And we've weaved it through the book, you know, always speak with your oncologist, your practitioner, your naturopathic oncologist, whoever it is that you're working with. Make sure that your protocol is tailored to you as an individual, because there are so many variables and lots of opportunities for things to go wrong. So you need somebody who understands how they work. They need to be monitoring your liver enzymes, need to be keeping an eye on the blood all of the time to make sure that you're not experiencing any of the negative effects of using lots of different kinds of modalities, basically.
Mm-hmm. That's it. A lot of people, they go on the internet, so there'll be those names circling around promoting very high doses of mebendazole, pembendazole, ivermectin.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's all very well, right? But my day job, you know, this is why I say, like, I monitor patients' bloods on a regular basis. They email me them, they update me all the time. You know, I think it's very, you know, it's not a patient's fault, but I think it's very dangerous when you put in personal protocols around that can be shared around in such a way when you're not following them up. Could I just mention this? Ivermectin, just as an example, it's something that I'm incorporating more into my protocols with the evidence base in a cautious manner, prescribed by a regulated pharmacy in this country, as opposed to taste, right? Which again, we laugh, we can chuckle about, because as you said, we said earlier, you're going to do what it takes. Take that horse paste, take that dog dewormer, if it means you can stay with your kids. You know, if there's an iota of it, might help you, right? This is an example, right? But then, you know, there are people who have very horrendous visual disturbances. They get blurry vision, they get flashing lights because they've got this impersonal thing and they bought medicines from India. So we don't want that. So what we're saying is, like, nah, like, we'll talk to you about the science. We'll educate you, inform yourself. We have to do this in this day and age with the information here. We have to inform ourselves and learn to process data, or try to, and have a forum where you can ask the right people the right questions and do it in the right way.
Mm. Very interesting. Well, to me, this is kind of the heart of the conversation today. You know, you would be seen by a conventional oncologist as a bit of a menace. You're giving the public another book telling them more about just DIY and, you know, getting out there and taking drugs without any knowledge or experience. And it's a good point, you know, from that point of view. So your message obviously is not that. People who actually read your book are going to find out they're not going to hear that. And I think it's very important to understand the trajectory of the whole repurposing movement. I mean, as you say, Jane McClellan's largely responsible for the whole thing. Now, she has got a brain the size of a planet, and she DIY'd it, but she's extraordinarily knowledgeable and intelligent. I don't think anybody who comes across and talks about this stuff will fail to notice that. And most people, they're not up to that. They haven't got that degree of understanding and learning. And so DIYing is just not really it under those circumstances. Okay, if you've got no money whatsoever and you're dying, well, you get as informed as you possibly can. That's the answer, okay? You just do the very best you can. Don't be cavalier about it and just take the first thing and just do whatever they say on this website. Really understand as best you can. But far preferably to that is actually to get some expertise, because nowadays, thanks to people like you, there are some places you can go and get expert advice, not just about the repurposed drugs, but about using them alongside the other treatments you might be doing. And this is, it's magic, you know. It's actually turned it from a sort of, you know, outback frontier, life-saving, desperate movement to something which is now making sense. It's now got all the science behind it. It's now a good thing to do for anybody, actually. It's not just something you do when you're desperate. It's actually a great thing to do. But it does require consulting people who really know how to manage your particular situation.
Yeah. No, fully agree. And it's about finding the practitioner that works for you as well. I mean, Harry has his clinic, I have my clinic. And also at the back of the book, is in the resources section, is the information about where you're able to get access to a practitioner directory. So that is also in the reference section at the back of the book as well.
Very useful. Okay, that's great. So look, One of the areas where kind of the alternative scene, if you like, has come to the fore has always been with like stage four patients. You know, when we started Yes to Life, they were the only people who called us up. You know, they'd had every chemo going and they were completely at rock bottom. They got a very short time to live and then they go desperately looking for something else. That's changed, I'm glad to say. Lots of sensible people call us up. It's the first thing they do. And we think, great, you know, you're going to be able to have all the resources of integrative medicine right from the start to even prepare you to go in for the first piece of surgery or whatever it is, you know, brilliant. But you get to stage four. People are at stage four when they get diagnosed. And I'm just interested to hear what's on offer from repurposing as a strategy for people in that position.
Yeah. So I mean, just to mirror your point, I mean, when I first sort of started working in pretty much the majority of my patients were stage four patients who maybe had progressed through multiple lines of treatment and were in a way hoping for a Hail Mary, you know, a bit of a miracle in a way. And this is some 10 years ago. And then I noticed that, you know, over time with the message getting out there to, you know, all the big names we know of, obviously engaged much earlier, literally having just been diagnosed or just having heard of the news, you know, and or maybe after their first disappointment. And I truly believe anecdotally that the greatest success of the, I'll just call it the metabolic approach, seemed to be in those who were using it as early as possible, maybe when the cancer was naive or more naive, or when the volume of disease was low, so after success, so after the first intervention, they were working very well with the first and the best line of treatment. So for me, where I am at the moment, if I meet a patient, whatever they are, say they're stage four, et cetera, I will say, well, I'll talk them through everything. I'll say, look, okay, this seems to be how your type of cancer works, functions, you know, how it feeds. You know, these are, I'll use my conventional knowledge to kind of fill the gaps about some of the awareness around the mutational testing and maybe even empower them in a little way to ask certain questions that they may not have known to. We will then talk about the core agents of most interest that again we'll all agree, you know, vitamin D and omega-3 and maybe a mushroom extract, and you know, and I might go only so far because I'll then, you know, bow down to the knowledge of people who know more than me, such as Matt, in that sense. I'll introduce them to the idea of drugs like metformin and statins and mebendazole and ivermectin and an antihistamine and so on and so forth, things that are relevant, for example, fluoxetine or an SSRI in brain cancer, or a bit of melatonin for estrogen receptor signaling blocking, or talk about LVN a little bit as well. So I'll, as I said before, think about the individual nuances and then so start academically building a plan. I'll introduce them to the idea of the ideology of a starve phase and a kill phase, intricately speaking, kind of block pathways and systems, and maybe have a bit more of a centered oppressive phase with high dose vitamin C and hyperbaric oxygen therapy. I'll introduce them to the ideas of mistletoe, because okay, you can imagine there's so much to talk about. So I try and chapterize things. I try and educate, get to know them, let them hear me rant away, and then let them talk to me and answer their questions, and then try and formulate academically a plan, and then logistically a plan, you know, in writing for maybe a chapter one for an initial 1 or 2 months. The concepts of the integrative therapies I'll introduce. Nowadays, I'll speak about sensitivity in vitro testing. So there's in vitro testing by blood by a company called Data, facilitated by myself now, but also by Astron Health, who you might know from PAD, a good friend of ours, and who is this brilliant company using AI learning and things. I'll introduce them to the idea of maybe considering sensitivity testing to help cut through the noise a bit, to maybe refine agents that might be of relevance. So I'm sure you know. So what they can do, they can capture circulating cells or try to in blood, look at the tissue, pair the analysis, and sort of look for mutational drivers of the cancer. There's a test called Exacta. Next generation sequencing like Foundation One, Caris Oncologica, Guardant 360. And then they go on further and maybe do some testing in the Petri dose test tube setting of individual agents one at a time to try and capture a signal. So there are nuances to it because in vitro testing is different to in vivo, but in vivo isn't commercially really accessible. And so you might get a signal that says, oh, actually, metformin is a waste of time, or ivermectin is great, but fenbendazole is also good, but better than mebendazole, you know, just that kind of information. So I'll pair that all, academic stuff, academic planning, maybe vitro testing, sensitivity testing, and then
you know, the output will be something tangible, and then it's the method of application, one at a time, low dosing, let's go cautiously, look at your bloods in 4 weeks, take a dirt, talk to, here's a letter for your consultant, let's ask them to talk about it, share it with their chemo pharmacist. So it's complex, but, you know, it's a journey. Sometimes I hate to use that word. It's a true journey. It's a journey. It's literally a journey of education, becoming well-informed. I truly believe, I think we all do, that it's empowering somewhat when you are more clued up about this. So the time and time again, I'll meet a patient, met one yesterday, and, talked about PIK3CA, ESR1, PD-L1, should we not test these things? Should we not repeat a biopsy because it's breast cancer? Yes, we don't like biopsies. So let's talk about that. What can we do to mitigate risk caused by biopsy? So there's so many elements to this, but that's what it is about, being dynamic, but it is about walking through, supporting, building confidence, building that knowledge base. And I think time and time again, the feedback and the satisfaction comes from patients really feeling quite ruled by that and enabled.
Fantastic. So in summary, there's a lot on offer.
There's a lot.
I'd say we're out of time. That was quick. So look, just remind us when a patient's going to be able to get their hands on this book, what's its title, and where else can they look for resources?
Okay, so the book is called Metabolic Drugs for Cancer. It will be published on Amazon. You should be able to get it across Amazon, any of the platforms, but definitely Amazon.com. And we should both have the download available on our websites as well. So that would be potentially a good resource for practitioners who want to do a search term. For example, they want to see what works well with breast cancer. So they might type breast cancer into the search term and then they get access to look through the whole document. So there's two different ways of accessing it.
Okay, so the we're talking about mid-November for publication.
Yeah.
And where your two websites are?
So mine is themetabolicnutritionist.com.
And mine is luciohealth.com, luciohealth.com.
Fantastic. Thank you both so much for a very dynamic and exciting and interesting chat about what has to be a very exciting, dynamic and interesting area of cancer treatment.
Thanks for having us. It's been great.
Having us. Appreciate you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
See you. Have a good day.
By the time you listen to this, the book will now be available in several formats, so do check it out. Many thanks for listening. I hope you found today's show helpful and interesting, and I invite you to join me again next week when I'll be back with the next Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.